Verulam Sports.
Hello again and welcome to Verulam Sports Podcasting with your host, Tony Rice. And it is a very, even more so than normal, excitable Tony Rice tonight, because he is truly honoured to be in the company of Dr. Simon Roth. Simon Roth is a true pioneer. His academic credentials speak volumes, but he is a reader in diplomatic studies out at the University of London, which is, as far as we are both aware, the very first version of this fantastic mode of study. So, Simon, welcome to Verulam Sports. How on earth are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Honestly, I massively appreciate your time, because I can only imagine how busy you must be. But goodness me, first and foremost, this pioneering course, want to learn all about it. But I also want to pay homage to yourself in the sense that, obviously, the nature of a podcast is it goes out globally. But we at Radio Verulam are based in St. Albans in the mighty Hertfordshire. And I know you hail from Stevenage. So, local boy, done good.
Something like that. I'm a certainly resident of North Hertfordshire at the moment. Have been since 2002, sort of Baldock, Letchworth.
Nice. And in 2002, time flies, doesn't it? I mean, goodness me, that's pushing 20 years now.
Getting there. It's getting that way, certainly. So, you know, it's almost a majority of my life.
Fantastic stuff. Well, great stuff. Well, look, I've been really eager to speak with you, Simon, because I shared a fantastic conversation quite recently, and it is available on our Radio Verulam podcast tab with Amran Malik, who is doing remarkably powerful things through his wickets program, which is nuanced, but most critically, incredibly structured, to unite communities through the power of sport. Just briefly, I know he delivered a lecture in your inaugural world first global only sports diplomacy forum. How did you guys meet?
We met through a mutual contact, which is the best form of diplomacy. It was word of mouth. Mm-hmm. A colleague who has his own international story, a Spaniard who met an English girl, came over. The rest, as they say, is history. But Jose Gigante, a very good friend of mine, he had come across Amran's work in Bedfordshire, that county before, and we were able to touch base at an event held at Senate House in London, the University. And I was utterly inspired by Amran's energy, which I'm sure, you know, is a feature of the podcast. And, you know, you get that sense when you're in his physical presence, but also in his presence. He's a loud gentleman in every
sense.
I love
that phrase. That is absolutely encapsulated Amran in a nutshell, you know. His energy and his passion shone through. And the great work that he's delivering and continues to deliver really blew me away. But now, having established that very connection, let's loop it back to sports diplomacy, because being a sports broadcaster, I'm massively passionate about sport and its power to unite communities. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure there are many different schools of thought here, but I would suggest that the essence of diplomacy is in finding commonality and uniting. So I guess the role of sports going forwards from a diplomatic angle is really important. I'm sure you'd concur.
There's a lot in that, Tony, a lot. Diplomacy is about finding common ground, but it's also about recognising where that can't happen.
Okay.
So sometimes there are things that go beyond the remit or indeed beyond the capabilities of any particular diplomatic function. That's why we end up in wars sometimes. You know, it's not you and I on a Friday night in Luton, but, you know, countries go to war because diplomacy at one level has failed. People have stopped talking to each other.
Right. So to what extent then is diplomacy at this level a constant negotiation?
Well, it's great that you mentioned the word negotiation, because diplomacy rests on three things: communication, negotiation, and representation. Those three things when you have them, that's the sort of hits the sweet spot, the back of the net, the perfect slam dunk of diplomacy. And those
three massively wonderful sporting idioms that you've weaved in there, I love it.
No, one can do that. It's not quite.
Well, at the end of the day, as those footballers say, this is really rather critical, though, isn't it? Continue.
It's certainly part of the dialogue, and it's one of the things that diplomacy and sport share. You know, you talk of the rules of the game. Well, those are rules of the game within sport and within diplomacy. There are protocols. You're talking about, and forgive me the gender specificity, gentlemanly conduct.
Absolutely.
You're talking about, we use phrases in the conduct of high diplomacy about, well, I didn't like the cut of his jib. Sailing reference. He's not cricket.
Whoa, back that one up again, because I'm familiar and au fait with the don't like the cut of his jib and just use it as a throwaway line. But I didn't actually know until you pointed out to me that it specifically originated due to the, the sailing boats. Fantastic. You've educated me, Dr. Simon Roth. That must be your stock in trade.
Well, one tries. Occasionally it comes off and some of it sticks and I like to think. But certainly, being able to weave together the vernacular of diplomacy and sport is one of the functions of this field of study. Note again, field of study.
Nice, of course.
So we see this emerging and it's really only a relatively new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So really, we can look at one of the legacies of London 2012, much debated, as being the foundational moment in the study of sports diplomacy.
You know what's interesting there? Sorry to cut in. I can imagine this debate is wide and varied, and I'm sure there are many learned gentlemen and indeed ladies who have their own take on that. However, my stance, coming back to this crucial word you've introduced there, is legacy, London 2012, right? And I'm sure you're very aware, aren't you? For instance, the Grecian stadia are in disarray. And obviously, that's not an isolated incident just off the top of my head, right? The point is, there is a historical precedent where post-Olympics, there was much chatter in order to get the honour of hosting an event, of building a legacy. But then subsequently, for XYZ unknowable many myriad factors, there was no zero, zilch, zippo legacy, right? But London 2012, I would suggest there is a lived legacy. And I think that is so crucial. Please, I'd love your take on what I've just kind of off the top of my head put out there.
Well, the one of the reasons why the discussion of legacy in sport mega events such as Olympic Games matters, particularly around London, is because the London bid said we were going to build a legacy. Mm-hmm. So previous bids and indeed hosting cities have not necessarily made that a strong part of their bid and then their experience. But London did. You'll recall that when Seb Coe went to Singapore in 2005, he took with him a group of children from the region in Stratford where the stadium was going to be rebuilt. And their lives, almost using them as an arc of a narrative about how legacy would be delivered into their lives, which was a very powerful message. In some senses, again, it's clever public relations. But it also allows you to build something, and it means that
Then you must deliver. Otherwise, it just becomes mere PR nonsense.
It does, and you can be very cynical about it and say, well, no one will be there to find out. But I think you do have, there's a considerable amount of educational legacy and learning opportunities from London 2012. I'd certainly reference the work of my colleague, Dr. Verity Postlethwaite, who wrote her PhD around the legacies, the contested legacies of London 2012. Mm. And there's a great deal of work, Gail McPherson's work and others who I would point to here. But I think there's also a key vision of legacy can't just happen once the game stops. You have to plan it from the outset. And that's where educational programs, and you see it now with organizations like the Jasur Institute, which is part of the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy of the World Cup in Qatar. It's called, the title of the organization is called Supreme for Delivery and Legacy. The clue's in the title, folks.
Well, there we go. Isn't it fascinating stuff right there? A bit Orwellian, perhaps, but I don't know much about this. I want to come back, though, to that. Those three core factors in diplomacy, right? How crucial is it then to find sort of commonality. Using Imran Malik as an illustration, one of the things that I found fascinating was, of course, cricket is at the core of how he is empowering the Luton communities, and the stats speak from themselves. I would encourage everybody to check out that podcast because it's an incredibly potent one, because again, Imran is not just a talker, he walks his walk, and my goodness me, doing wonderful things. But Simon, what was I'm fascinated about is in particular the reference that he made to cricket combat, where there was obviously, again, talking diplomacy, talking kind of engagement, talking on a level communication to a focused goal, right? It was clear that some people, cricket just simply didn't resonate. They were more into MMA, mixed martial arts. And so he delivered it. He fought that, noted a deficit, a problem, flipped it on its head and said, right, here we have cricket combat or combat cricket. Half of the time we would focus in on MMA. Obviously, that's got their buy-in. Wonderful. And then the other half have got cricket. Wonderful. So we're killing two birds, one stone, to use a hackneyed cliche, and in turn, building the process, getting them engaged. And if it is the case that then they try cricket because they had barriers against it and they're in, great. It, nevertheless, it still means we're achieving our common goals of giving opportunities to young people through sport. So again, that for me is absolutely key. And explain from your understanding the role of reacting to the environment that you are faced with and how sport specifically can achieve that.
The sport can be, sport's a form of communication. It requires communication to play well if you're in a team sport, and it requires communication because you have to be able to not only, you know, as it were, organise yourself on the pitch,
yes,
or team room, but you have to be able to organise the fixture. You have to pick up the phone and call someone and know where to meet. You know, how many players are playing? How many, you know, what are the rules of the game? Even if they're sort of local rules that emerge, you know, is it, well, we play, you know, with, you know, the fence line, and then it's the, you know, the...
Yeah, end of- you define the borders, I guess.
You do, to use a diplomatic metaphor, you know, defining the borders of the game, because you're setting it up. And each, you know, some of those rules, you don't have to say. You don't have to write down. You don't have to write them down in a code of governance and have them approved by anyone else. Because if half a dozen people turn up and, you know, start kicking a ball about, you've got a game. You don't have to have a referee. You know that the, you know, it's jumpers for goalposts.
Yeah.
And mum calls you home. You know, you don't have to have those rules. But you, if you develop it and progress it, then you get more and more into that.
Question to you then. Given that that's possible on a local level, and given that's achievable, and we've all had those type of experiences, and they were so full of joy for me, just to kick around with your mates. No pressure, it's just great fun. But given that's possible without the formal codification, extending that abstractly, does the formal codification come with stress, hassles? Maybe are we losing something by perhaps becoming slavish to a formalization process?
You lose the idea of free play. What the Brazilian footballers learned on the beach was more important than what they were taught in a coaching course. And you lose some of that frisson, the X factor.
Ah.
You know, the I don't know what they're going to do next. You know, the sort of Cantona-esque shirt collar up.
Yeah. Do you know what? Talking Cantona, that goal against Sunderland always sticks in my mind, because you know what? The celebrations of the world, it's fantastic. The emotion running through everybody. You've just got to love it. It's why we love sports, as many reasons, of course, other than that. But that's one of my favourite all-time celebrations, because it was just the look of absolute certainty with no doubt about it. I'm the man.
Brilliant. Well, that's it. And, you know, there's something about sport that allows for that performative quality. You're an actor on a stage, but you've got to have stagehands. You've got to have the lighting. You've got to have the sound. You've got to have an audience. You know, I may have scored the same goal in the park on my own. No one there to see it. You know, it goes back to the old, does a tree make a noise if it falls in the wood and no one's there?
Oh, goodness me. We're into some kind of, existential matters here. But that's also one of the reasons that I truly passionately love sport, because sport for me is, of course, like all things in the world and in society, a mirror and indeed a reflection of the sum total of where it's fitted into any given context. So in our context, in the what we will refer to historically as the COVID-19 era, tell me a little bit about how sport has had to pivot and, more crucially, future gaze. What more can sport do, diplomatically speaking, to re-evaluate how we as individuals locate ourselves within communities and then into the global panorama, if that's possible? I know there's a lot to unpack there.
There is quite a bit. So there's a couple of things. One, during the course of COVID, particularly the first phase and the first lockdowns in the United Kingdom, I was very taken by the idea of a sort of solo social spectrum of sport, where sports that were solo, things you could do on your own, not only became very popular in relative terms, but were you could do. Whereas sport that you had a social dimension to, so team sports, were banned for our own public health. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you can argue up and down what government rules are back and forth, not the course of this podcast. But sport became one of the few things you could do. You could leave your house for four reasons. One of them, sport. That makes sport pretty powerful.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I mean, I can speak for myself. It was salvation for me. Being able to go out on my bike was absolute salvation. Anything over and above that is a bonus. So, you know, the opportunity to re-engage in team sports and be part of those kind of processes has been fascinating and welcome and everything. But sport has sustained individuals and communities of individuals, and sport has found a way to adapt to that. So some of the greatest social experiences, if I don't mind admitting, have been in sports stadia with thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands of other people.
But can you super quickly just recall, without overthinking, your most favourite experience of precisely that? A stadia experience where maybe your team won, for instance. Your most favourite?
26th of May, 1999, Camp Nou.
The Nou Camp. You know what? I'm thinking it must be some type of Champions League-esque encounter.
Yeah, you know, 1-0 down in the 90th minute, 3 minutes later.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was just, quite frankly, it's written in sporting folklore, isn't it? And it's the apotheosis of Fergie time. And my word, didn't they step up to the plate? I love that moment. And I'm definitely not a Red Devil.
Yeah, well, but there's moments of vitriol. Being in at Wembley in 1996, watching Stuart Pearce score that penalty against Spain, the moment of redemption, where he utterly, you know, he scores the goal and he celebrates, and then it hits him 6 years after what happened.
Yeah. And it's a long time, 6 years, particularly with that plaguing you.
Yeah, but the, you know, and that he shouldn't even have been playing had Lasso not got injured earlier in the year. All of these come together. That is the narrative that sport gives you.
It's simply magical, I would suggest.
I'm not magical, tragic. It's everything that, you know, makes me, you know, it's still the image of those things that makes the hair stick up on the back of my neck.
So with that emotion, again, that's one of the keys to sport. Let's take this journey forwards now into the obviously post-COVID-19 era. What more are you doing in this fascinating pioneering course to get people at a higher level conscious of just precisely the vital role that sport will play in how we consider our ontology?
There's a long word, ontology.
I don't know. It's only four syllables from three, four, maybe. Not that long.
Whole lectures that one can give about ontology. To jump to the end, this is about how we understand the world we live in. And sport will play a significant role in that. Some of the key markers of return to normalcy are sporting ones. You know, when the Premier League returned, whether you think it should or shouldn't, it makes a difference. With the cancellation of the IPL, or the suspension, forgive me, of the IPL, you see another intervention.
India is suffering, as we all know right now, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the first markers of the lockdown coming was Mikel Arteta contracting COVID and a high-level Premier League game being postponed. Now, that was significant. You know, it wasn't, you know, a university lecture being postponed. It wasn't a performance of the opera being performed. Because if you cancel a Premier League game, as we saw at the weekend when the United...
Power to the people, perhaps.
then you actually have a real, you know, people take notice, and importantly in diplomatic terms, people take notice around the world, and there are legal, financial consequences to that. So these are all parts of the same equation that we need to take account of. And it's why, going back to the emotional part, you have on the one hand the sort of huge emotional capacity of sport, and on the other hand you have the cold-hearted raison d'être of diplomacy. And that's why sports diplomacy is such a fascinating thing, because you have huge emotion on the one hand. Diplomacy is almost defined by the absence of emotion.
Do you know what, just to interject there, and I'm terribly sorry because I'm talking to the man who's pioneering this, but I found, just generally speaking, that things are never quite as sort of clear-cut as that. You know, I don't think it would be right or proper to see and frame diplomacy as this cold raison d'être force, and sport as merely this emotional catalyst for whatever it might be. I think all of these yin-yangs and dance, and it's why it's so fascinating. But that's my take on it. And I know you are a doctor here on this subject, so please continue a little bit more.
Well, no, and I take your point. I think they're much more mixed up. But I think society and the structures and many of the processes at work do distinguish them. You know, sport is not seen as high politics. Sport is something that's peripheral. It's something you do after. It's something extra. It's you know, how long has it been on the national curriculum? How long have we recognised it? What values do we place on it? It's something that happens over there. You know, real politicians want to be, you know, chancellor. They want to be head of the health service. They don't want to be head of sport. Like, you know.
Yeah, no, listen, on that level, I totally take your point. But, you know, one wonders, are these the right characters to be employed in diplomacy? But I don't know much about the cost of eggs, even.
Well, you know, diplomacy, they are, you know, sometimes you need to be cold-hearted. You know, if you're adjudicating on a doping case, then that's, you know, a matter of jurisdiction, sovereignty. They're the same things as, you know. Sometimes, you know, it's not all about your, you know, Stuart Pearce moments or, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer moments. It's much more about, you know, the, you know, 0-0 draw at home, you know, to, or, you know, those cold and windy nights away at Stoke that everyone, you know, caricatures.
And this is, no, seriously, but this is one of the reasons, again, that I truly massively appreciate sport, and of which I do on a very deep level. Look, it's the fact that actually when you learn about sport a little bit or listen into sport, it's these sporting cliches that I find actually very compelling at the end of the day. Because, you know, what they really are, I think, is a shortcut to get to a frame of understanding. Now, surely it's that also to short-circuit disputes, diplomatically speaking, sort of on a quasi-linguistic level, that we are also needing to elevate. Maybe I'm talking a little assertively, but I just wonder if what I said there was off the beaten path or not.
I don't think it's not massively off the beaten path, and I think we're, you know, there is a yin and yang, to use your phrase there, and there is a symbiosis understood, or that's the way I understand it, and that's the way I've come to understand it from studying diplomacy and sort of the hard security dimensions of that, but also to think about the softer side of diplomacy. What gets people, you know, around the conference table to sign the document? Is it the air temperature? Is it the, you know, the quality of the food? All of these kinds of things. You know, are you able to have a quiet moment in the corridor beforehand asking about whether your son's, you know, football team's doing well? They're the points of connection. They're the communication. You know, that's the reason why you have these, you know, opportunities. And I think those things we should not underestimate as being sort of lubricant that sometimes can get harder, you know, deals done. You know, there's huge amounts of discussion at the moment around vaccine diplomacy. And, you know, the opportunity to talk about how that drips into what diplomacy where does that sit on the spectrum?
I mean, that is the elephant in everybody's room right about now. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall in certain higher powered individuals, because, you know, there's a lot at stake at this moment, pivotal moment in our history, my opinion again. So moving it forward, but I'm back a little bit. the role of sport then within diplomacy and how it impacts on our world, for your point of view, you've mentioned and you've explained really eloquently, of course, that it is maybe historically, traditionally, a bit of a periphery, perhaps an afterthought. How are we moving that maybe into the foreground, or should we still keep it a little bit as its own entity?
I think sport is gaining prominence because if you think, you know, in the last 6 months in the UK, sportsmen and sports issues have been things that have punctuated the overarching around COVID. So you can look at the responsibilities of one young man from Withenshaw in Manchester who changed government policy on three occasions. You know, Marcus Rashford got the government to reverse policy on school meals during the summer, during half term, and then...
Indeed.
And, you know, he's an intelligent, articulate individual. But
he's got his finger on the pulse of the power of social media too.
He does, and he's got some very good management people. He happens to be also a very good footballer and, you know, hopefully score some goals for England in the summer.
I've no doubt that's going to happen.
He'll also, you know, has made a point of making, you know, hunger a campaign. Yeah. And he's made the opportunity to educate young people also through his education books that have just been launched. So,
yes.
You know, he's an individual who's taken his athlete agency, you know, he's given prominence and wealth because of his abilities. And he's
richly
taken...
deserved, I think, too.
Well, one can argue that up and down. I agree. But, you know, others may not. But the point is he's used his communication, his negotiation and his representation to be able to affect policy change. This is on a national level.
Yes,
but it's international impact. And it's had regional impact.
Here's a question to you, because I think this is a perfect illustration, right? I'm a humongous fan of American sport, in particular the NFL, right? And there's lots of that I could move that forward, but I'm just going to park it for a minute and come back to this point, right? Because what Marcus Rashford has done so tremendously is essentially what each and every individual in an American sporting culture does, at least in my understanding in the NFL, right? So each and every individual will be responsible, right? I don't know if it's contractually obliged. That's at the moment beyond my frame of reference, right? It remains the case that every single person who's earned the honour to don a jersey in the NFL will go back out into the community. They'll have their own equivalent programs, and that's therefore happening on a much more compounded level than this illustration that we brought to the table here of Rashford. Do you think that Rashford could be akin to you, Dr. Simon Roth, as a bit of a pioneer, and we may well see something like that? If so, are we at the pivotal moment where we are beginning to catch up culturally with American sports and how they understand their role in their communities?
If I may, Tony, I would take a little issue with your appreciation of American sport. Having spent, you know, 3 years in the US as a undergraduate student and living with in the sports dormitories, not throughout my sporting prowess, but because they put the international students in with the athletes, I'm not sure that American athletes are any better off or worse off, indeed, than UK. I think there's a variety in that. I think within different sports, it becomes part of their different contractual obligations. And here I'd point to the NBA, the National Basketball Association. The NBA Cares campaign, to my mind, is infinitely more substantial than the NFL's obligations. I think, you know, the NFL has its own set of problems. I also admire it hugely and go to the games in London as and when.
Yeah, international series. Can't wait for it to be back coming up in October.
Although I will mean going to Spurs, but we'll get over that.
Well, long conversation. Let's carry on.
The opportunity, but what they have done, and again, this is high controversial, particularly at the moment, through the NCAA in the United States, which is the College Collegiate Association, which governs collegiate sport, which is essentially a feeder into the
profession, isn't it?
Is that you know, the ethical questions around that are huge, because you've got institutions, universities, making huge amounts of money off athletes who are students who cannot make any money themselves. So I think, you know, the American model is problematic. Apart from the fact that it churns out many, you know, dysfunctional athletes, if you like, not for their own fault, but because the system doesn't look after them as well as it might.
Okay.
It looks different ways to the British Academy system, for example, in football. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot here about athlete welfare.
Yeah.
And so I think the point that you're driving at is a sort of counterpart between athlete agency on the one hand and athlete welfare on the other. And an organisation called Global Athlete, I would say, is a sort of almost a trade union advocacy organisation for athletes who can challenge the likes of the IOC. Mm-hmm. And they're so I think it's a huge subject and one that requires further research.
Do you know what? I'll tell you what, I really appreciate your slant on that massively. Maybe because I just had a slightly romantic take on the NFL, just purely from my love of the game. But coming back, though, to the analogy, it's still interesting, though, nevertheless, I think culturally, that they are, whether it's contractually or whether it's better done in other sports in the States, the case that there is more of a collective appetite to do pro bono, awesome, life-changing work, a la Rashford. Again, do you think Rashford will be this pioneer and other agencies of all sporting types will follow suit? Or is there still going to be, here in the UK, a reticence towards that, I wonder?
I'm without being, you know, too much a victim of my professional training, I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question. I don't think you can say that the US system is serving all of its constituents sufficiently well, that Rashford is catching up in any fashion.
Sure.
There are individuals on both sides who are doing wonderful things. You know, there are lots of players in this country and lots of players who don't make any announcement about their foundations, and they do an awful lot of good work, whether in their local communities or at, you know, you could look at the examples of Craig Bellamy and Nwankwo Kanu, you know, players who, you know, have chosen to spend, you know, they're not inconsiderable wealth, but in particular ways. And these are things that you need to have a recognition of, at least in my mind, before we start thinking about how you can take advantage of individuals. And I'm aware about that, and particularly in the most high profile sports. I think if you can look at, you know, what work is being done by an organization like such as GoldClick, which is capturing images.
Sorry, Simon, could you just repeat that for me, please?
Yeah, I would thoroughly recommend goldclick.com. It's a you know, wonderful organization that's doing some really interesting things, but capturing sport in a way that you and I would not do unless you went and looked at the website.
I'm on the case. I like that. Yeah. Thank you.
Look, but the point here is that there are other ways to access sport. And that is a really important narrative. It's not just who's got the most Twitter followers.
Yeah.
It's not in the news. But the second part of the conversation that I wanted to bring it back to in terms of what sport has influenced and shaped the nature of our country in the last 6 months, mm-hmm. found the reaction to the ESL, the European Super League. Because that, you know, as it were, the power to the people and the fans objected to it.
Yeah.
But it was a coalition of the president and of UEFA, Alexander Shefflin. It was the broadcasters themselves with the existing contracts, as opposed to the broadcasters who might have the new contracts. It was, you know, the football authorities, so the Football Association, the Premier League, but it was also individuals in that. So the future head of our country, Prince William, who will be at one point, you know, God willing, king, or happens to also be president of the Football Association. So the kings, you know, the future king said something about it.
Yes.
The prime minister, whatever you make of him.
Indeed.
Quick to get in on the act. And you have other teams, you know, earn it. You know, football is for the fans. All of these things, you have a huge coalition. of multinational stakeholders.
Yes.
Essentially, an argument between six UK owners or owners of UK football clubs, three of whom are in the United States. And
indeed. Yes.
Of the United States. And then you've got our friends in the Middle East.
Indeed.
And our friends in Russia. So you end up with, in complete, as it were, contrast to what you might think about the state of international politics.
Indeed.
Essentially a coalition of Russia, the Middle East and China telling Yankee capitalism and winning. Now, normally, the United Kingdom would be on the side of our friends across the Atlantic and yes. not on in Moscow, Beijing and the Middle East.
Well, tell you what. What a turbulent state of affairs that was. And, you know, it really is, I think, a fascinating long conversation to unpack it to its proper level. But, yeah, I really would love you to tell me a touch more about whether you were shocked, given that the decision was made, that then the wrangles came into effect such that it was very quickly put to bed and it's now kind of their tails between their legs, it would seem to me.
Their tails are between their legs and their PR has been appalling, because any good PR person would tell you to, you know, you need to know the outcome before you raise the prospect. So you can't float this out at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon with no prior knowledge and expect everything to go, that's a brilliant idea, wish we'd thought of it. You end up in a scenario where people, respond, and this is another part of your sort of, resistance identity here, the work of Manuel Castells.
Sorry, remind me of that reference again, could you?
Manuel Castells, he's a Spanish sociologist who talked very much about different forms of identity and identified a sort of resistance identity. So, if you're at a football match, you have a resistance identity to the away fans if you're the home team. And if you're an away team, you love going because you're resistant to the home identity. You will sing and shout louder because a portion of your fans and a larger portion of home fans. So all of these things, provide a sort of narrative to play out. But the resistance here is really in opposition to change. That said, the ownership models still exist and the issues that underpin their concerns still exist. So the manifestation of the European Super League will happen into a fashion anyway, and may well have been the best thing that could have happened to the controversial plans in themselves, the Champions League.
Can I just say, I've been actually advocating the potential beauty of a well-managed, properly conceived European Super League for a generation. But I'll tell you something, that is a very, very long conversation to give it context. And I know you will be able to unpack it because it is kind of predicated upon a slightly shaky, romantic take on the culture of the US system, which would require a paradigm shift in our psyche to even really be comprehensible. But there we go. For you, Simon, don't overthink this one. Is a evolution of the Champions League, some typoid of European League, Super League breakaway, an inevitability, as I think somebody in The Matrix said?
I'm not sure it's inevitable, because I see evolution rather than revolution more often than not. There may appear to be a big break, and there may be, but I think the onus has been put back onto UEFA to provide some answers into this space. And UEFA may step up. It's possible. Seferin has done, a considerably better job than his predecessor, regardless of, his relative footballing abilities. Platini. Yep. Regime was not geared in that sense. So I think there's opportunities here, and I'd be certainly keen to see, I'm less, and I have been hugely privileged to be a team that I supported, which took a long time to win anything, win the Champions League myself. Mm. And they are amongst the best, you know, moments of my life.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm not a, you know, I recognise it's changed and it will change again. Mm. The opportunity for competition, though, the fundamental thing about sport, is if I was to leave you with anything, is about the uncertainty of outcome.
Interesting.
You don't know the outcome. You know that Real Madrid stand a really good chance of beating most teams in La Liga most weeks, but they don't.
Any given Sunday, at the end of the day, it's just a game, and that's why we love the romance of the FA Cup as a prime example, I guess.
Well, you know, you just don't know the outcome. You know, we all know those outcomes when the story, you know, when the crazy gang beat the Culture Club. You know,
absolutely, 88 FA Cup final.
Know that, but we also have, you know, we know that because that's the break from the norm. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time, you know, 22 men run around for 120 minutes and then, you know, Germany beat us on penalties.
Oh, so. Don't. I was trying to go there with you, and you really brought me slamming down. Now you brought that into its clear focus. Oh, goodness me. But there we go. Simon, I could discourse with you for many a long while, but I'm conscious that you've gifted me 52 minutes of your precious time. It's been a real joy to enjoy your company tonight. Before I let you go, in this wonderful, pioneering, global first sports diplomacy course at the University of London that you are instrumental in having a factor in creating, where can we go to learn more information about that, please?
Well, the simplest thing is to look on the university's website, but probably the easiest Google is Dr. J. Simon Roof. And that will take you to a number of pages about me. The value of having an odd name is that Google throws me up over and over.
The cynic in me might say that you've also got, you're terribly au fait with the marketing bods, perhaps.
Well, probably, but you know, I understand that it keeps my name. So, yeah.
I don't want to become an all the way cynic, though, never. So Simon, please, once again, remind us all how we can learn more about yourself, the pioneering work that you do, and just build upon the interesting topics that we've been lucky to talk about tonight. Please remind us of the best way to engage with you online.
At Dr. J. Simon Roof on Twitter.
Top man. Dr. Simon Roof, once again, in closing, I want to extend my gratitude for your time and your company. It's been a genuine pleasure. I'd like to wish you all the continued success and happiness you richly deserve, and I shall look forward to enjoying your company in the near future. Much obliged.
Be my pleasure. Take care.